Welcome to episode 21 of the Serious About Security podcast for Tuesday, November 27, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SERIAS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SERIAS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
In announcements today, we have the SERIAS Security Seminar, which has more great speakers over the next few weeks. We will be kind of running into the end of the semester soon, and I believe we only have two more on the list. And those are Ashish Kundu from IBM Research, who will present a new class of buffer overflow attacks on November 28th. And Ashish is a former SERIAS PhD student. Bilal Shabaro from Purdue will also present on December 5th. These seminars will be available at Stewart Center in room G52 at 4:30 on Wednesdays. They are also broadcast live on the Purdue channel in the Lafayette area. They are available as podcasts and on YouTube. See the SERIAS website for more details, www.cerias.purdue.edu.
The last Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Meeting of 2012 will be on December 13th at 11:30 a.m. in Young Hall. As is customary for our December presentation, we'll be focusing on our careers. Keith Watson will be speaking about managing your career in information security. If you don't manage your career, someone else might just do it for you. Come join us and participate in the discussion. And as always, don't forget to bring your lunch.
We have one news item this podcast. Mozilla Firefox and Thunderbird were updated to version 17, which corrected 6 critical and 9 high vulnerabilities in Firefox, and 5 critical and 7 high vulnerabilities in Thunderbird. And that's it. Patch Tuesday will be next podcast. So I don't think Microsoft has released their early security advisory for that, but keep a watch out.
So for articles this week, I selected the one related to the FreeBSD project. Unfortunately, the FreeBSD project suffered a security breach, although it was fairly limited in scope. They had an announcement that came out on November 17th, which described the initial issue in which two machines in the FreeBSD.org infrastructure were found to have been compromised. And after some research, they discovered that this was believed to have occurred because of a leak of an SSH key from one of the developers who had legitimate access to the servers. So somebody may have compromised his machine, captured his key, or something like that, and used that to gain access to the package building machines. In FreeBSD, you build software packages that can be downloaded and used on FreeBSD servers. And these were the only two machines that appeared to have been compromised by that. And they believe the initial attacker was able to gain access approximately the 19th of September and had access all the way up to the 11th of November. And so they've done a complete review and looked at what machines may have been touched and what packages may have been affected. And they also reviewed the source code repository to see if any changes were actually pushed out to the source code. And after review, they were not able to find that the Subversion repository or the Perforce repositories had been compromised. They did have some concerns about the FreeBSD 9.1 package collection, and so those were all deleted and rebuilt. They didn't know whether those had been modified or not, so as a precaution, they basically deleted all the compiled packages and then checked out the clean version of the source code known to be good, and then started the process over rebuilding all that. And so in addition to the two machines that were compromised, they did take down a bunch of the infrastructure and started a review and an audit process to see what happened. And in fact, I noticed this because SERIAS maintains an OS mirror of the FreeBSD collection, and we mirror that from ftpmaster.freebsd.org, and that site actually went down. for several days, and so I kept getting email messages from our update process saying, hey, I can't talk to this guy. So we noticed it that way. That was one of the machines that was impacted. But that's back up now. And so part of this compromise has led to some changes or some acceleration of changes, let's say. The source code that FreeBSD uses is managed under Subversion. Previously had been managed under CVS. And the CVS mirror and CVS update system have been deprecated. They still work, but they won't work much longer. And so all the developers who check out source code are encouraged to switch over to the Subversion repository once again. And those people that are using the ports collection, which is the allows you to build packages from source on your local machine, those people are encouraged to use a port snap tool. And this is a way of downloading just the changes to the ports files that have been made over time. And it actually has digitally signed files from the developers. So you can be a little more confident in the integrity of that code. And some other things have changed as well. But basically, the point is they had a minor compromise. They did some auditing. They took down the infrastructure until they could figure out what happened, verified that those parts that they were unsure of had been rebuilt from clean source, and had brought those systems back online. What we don't know is about policy changes or internal changes. That part's not been mentioned too much, you know, what they're requiring their own developers to do in terms of security. But I thought this was very interesting. It kind of harkens back to some other issues that the Linux project had. And in fact, where kernel.org, which is the main site for the Linux kernel, was down for a month after they had a pretty serious compromise. So this seems to be less in comparison to that issue, but this is a problem that we've seen before with other open source projects. And part of the problem is if an attacker gets access to source code and can make changes that are undiscovered, and those changes get pushed out, it's very interesting the impacts that can be realized that way. So I found this to be interesting. It's kind of a minor one, but it could have been much worse, I guess.
Yeah, I found it interesting how the compromise occurred as well. There's not a – at least I didn't find a great level of detail as far as how that private key was exploited, but I'm assuming that it was probably just on a developer had it on the same machine he was using, and that machine was compromised, and therefore the private key was obtained. And again, I didn't see any details whether or not that key was password protected, but I'm going to assume that it probably was not. And so there was a couple events took place that kind of helped let this unfold. So as you mentioned, Keith, there hasn't been any comment as far as like policies and procedures, what might be changing. But I imagine they're probably looking at these things saying, you know, it's really a good idea not to keep the private key in this location. It should be kept in a secured location. Furthermore, it should be password protected so that these types of events can be avoided. I know I've used public-private key pairs, and it's really convenient. It's really nice. And, I wonder how many machines that really could have impacted. I know they mentioned a couple, but I would think as a developer, he might have had access to several different machines using that key pair. So I guess just a good reminder that, those types of keys should be protected.
Well, and going back to the password protection thing, I mean, we talk about two-factor authentication, and essentially password protecting your private key is a form of two-factor authentication. You have your private key, and you know the password to it. If somebody gets your password and they don't have your private key, they can't use it. If somebody has your private key and they don't have the password, they can't use it. So it's kind of a multi-factor system, which it doesn't really require any significant infrastructure or anything like that to maintain. And it's just good practice to do that. It's just kind of, you know, people kind of get lazy and think their systems are more secure than what they really are. And it's really easy to use. You know, if you don't need a password, you just go right in. And, you know, it's so simple. But, you know, this kind of thing can happen when you don't take the proper security stance.
Yeah, and we don't have enough information really to know. We can guess. It could have been somebody captured keystrokes and figured out what his passphrase was to his SSH key. Could be he didn't have password protection on the key. We don't know. There could be, you know, as far as we know, there aren't any weaknesses in SSH agent, which is the daemon that runs in the background and manages your keys and your access to those keys when you log into remote servers. So we don't know. There's no reason to suspect that at this point. It could be just user error. And we don't know. But going back to SSH, SSH, we love it. You know, if you're in the security community or a developer community, you're probably using this thing every day. I was logged into probably 10 different machines using SSH. And it's a great tool. The one downside, I think, and it's not really a downside, it's just the nature of the beast, is configurability. The tool is so flexible. There are so many configuration options, and there's a lot of ways you can screw it up if you're not careful. For the most part, out of the box, it's reasonably set up in a reasonable way. And if you're using if you log into a remote machine, it asks you for your passphrase to decrypt your private key. Well, you know, you can always hit return and enter your password. So an attacker using that information might have the password and doesn't need the private key, for example, to get into a server. So there's all these issues that have to be addressed. I mean, the really great thing about having these private keys is you can do that authentication piece, and you can have different passwords on a whole bunch of servers. But once you lose access to that private key, then all bets are off, because then that private key is what's used to authenticate you everywhere. And so it's a great tool, and, you know, you got to be careful how you use it. And in fact, there's a lot to SSH in terms of configuration. And most of what everybody uses these days is OpenSSH. It's been ported to pretty much everything. But there are other clients as well, and each of those have their own unique characteristics as well. So there are a couple SSH books out there that talk about a lot of this detail. But I think they're, you know, these books are getting on in 7 or 8 years old now. So I'm not sure if there's been a significant change in SSH in terms of configurability, and it's probably not really relevant to this discussion, but it'd be interesting to see if a lot of changes have occurred compared to what's documented in terms of books and best practices these days.
All right, well, we'll move on to the next article, which is mine, and this one's about SCADA systems, which we've talked about before. One article says Italian security firm, the other article says it's Maltese. They have Italy, but they crossed it out, so I'm guessing they probably have an Italian domain and they're actually located somewhere else. But this security firm called, or arguably a security firm, I'll put that caveat on it. Revolm is their name. They claimed to have discovered a few dozen vulnerabilities in SCADA systems. This security firm's policy is to not disclose these vulnerabilities, but to sell them to their customers. And so they don't disclose them to the vendor, and they don't disclose them to any of the vulnerability kind of like CERN and places like that. So we don't know what they are. But another independent security company, what was their name? Exodus Intelligence, said, okay, well, I'll look for them myself. And he found 20 security vulnerabilities. The first one he found within 7 minutes of looking. These are on various SCADA systems, and some are remote code execution vulnerabilities, denial of service vulnerabilities, and things like that. And it's kind of concerning that these systems that run, you know, some critical infrastructure, electrical systems, traffic control systems, things like that, are so easily vulnerable to things like that. And that's one part. And the other part is that this security firm, Revolm, which kind of is, it seems fairly irresponsible and somewhat unethical to have the mindset that I'm not going to release my, I found vulnerabilities, but I'm not going to disclose them to anybody. I'm going to keep them so I can sell to customers. And who knows who these customers are going to be. I'm guessing they probably have a security tool and you can check to see if you're vulnerable or something like that. But I really don't know how these things are supposed to get fixed without disclosing them. And if a security firm is concerned about security, as they say, then disclosure seems like it would be something you would want to do if you are if you want to deal in malicious tools, then you wouldn't want to disclose. If you want to actually keep things secure, you would want to disclose. And I just wanted to know what you two thought of these two issues.
Well, I kind of agreed with your assessment of Revolm, I think is what they're calling themselves. You know, I was trying to assess, like you said, they call themselves a security firm, but, you know, who are their clients, and do they really care who their client is that they're selling this information to? I mean, is there a business model to sell it to folks that would want to exploit these vulnerabilities? You know, I don't know enough about what their business model is, but in any case, it seems wrong. It seems like they're exploiting the fact that they can find these vulnerabilities and want to turn around and sell them. You know, there's a quote in the article from the founder of Revolm that says that the ICS cert had just contacted them, but we don't release information. The vulnerabilities are part of our portfolio for our customers, so no public details will be released. They will remain private. And I wondered if in that event, if, you know, the vendors call them up directly and say, you know what, well, you know, are they wanting the vendors to contact them directly and say, you know, I know you have some exploits against our site, you know, we'll pay you for them. Is that the model they're going for? Because selling them to anyone else other than, you know, the manufacturers and the vendors is really selling it to individuals that could use those exploits for no good. They're not the ones who have the ability to fix the software. They're only individuals that can exploit it. So, you know, I had a lot of concern when I read that. I think it'll be interesting to see. It sounds like this is a fairly new security firm. You know, I say security firm kind of in air quotes there. So I'm curious to see what will happen over time, if they will be able to establish themselves as a solid business, or if they will just kind of go away. But it was, you know, what's really concerning here is, you know, we've talked about the SCADA systems on previous podcasts, and the fact that, you know, these are the types of systems, you know, running power and water, you know, electricity. These are the kind of systems that you don't want to go offline. They're very much a significant part of our infrastructure. So, you know, the fact that some vulnerabilities were discovered on these systems, I think, even kind of ups the ante. These are the ones that you want to get fixed. You don't want them to be sold to individuals that could use them for harm.
So, the Revolm company, the founder of which, Luigi Aramina, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's the name that I see, has a quote in another article on ThreatPost related to their business model. And basically he says, and this is a quote from the article, "Our target is mainly the defensive security, providing information only to selected companies and governments. Currently, we don't have limitations regarding the types of software to test, but obviously SCADA and ICS systems are our priority. For the rest, we provide consulting and training services." So, selected companies and governments, is the people they sell these things to. I would be interested in seeing that list, but obviously they're not going to share that. So they seem to be in the business to do one thing, and that is to make money. They're not in the business of public good. They're in the business of private good, if you will. They're going to help their customers, those with big checkbooks, basically, provide them with information about these exploits so that they can better defend their own systems. I think the business model here is understandable, but I don't agree with it. That's my opinion, personally, because it would be better if we took that information and allowed vendors to make corrections so that everybody could benefit from this. But clearly, these guys aren't doing that. The other company that's mentioned Preston mentioned, Exodus Intelligence, their approach is different. Their approach is, if we find a zero day, we're going to report it. And I think they looked at ISC cert as a or ICS cert as the way that they would do their reporting. So there's another company in France, the name of which escapes me at the moment, which is doing something very similar. And they're basically selling these exploits for profit. And they're not in the business of responsible reporting of these things. So will be interesting to see how this business plays out. Unfortunately, I did talk to a defense contractor who's a sponsor of Sirius that had their own team to find zero-day exploits and also bought them on the open market. And I asked him why, and was that the right thing for his company to do? And he said, we have to do it because everybody else is doing it. I don't agree with that mindset either, but that's the answer I got from them.
Okay, well, I just wanted to point out one more thing in the article related to essentially SCADA system security. And this was the person from Exodus Intelligence who said that basically it's not the security in SCADA systems that he sees is the difficulty in finding them, but once you find them, breaking into them is extremely simple. That's basically what he said. He said so instead of having your security in having secure software, your security is in keeping people away from your software. And that's essentially his idea on how SCADA does their security.
Yes, and then we've seen that many times. In fact, we talked about the whole Iranian problem with the issues associated with the malware that attacked those sites. I mean, these were assumed to be offline, and yet they were still connected to a network not on the internet, but still a network, and that was another way to get in. So that model of, well, it's not connected to a public network, doesn't work anymore. In fact, there's that search engine, which also the name of which I forget, which allowed you to look for various devices connected up to the internet, and you could find whether they were SCADA devices based on certain search parameters. So they're easy to find, and they're out there. And unfortunately, the vendors have not done themselves any good by hiding the fact, suing people or threatening to sue people who would release the information, and then making it very difficult for those who've installed them to figure out how to upgrade them, if that's even possible with the systems that they're using too. And then, of course, in their software development lifecycle process, they don't have anything that addresses security testing, upgradability of these devices. So once they're in place, they typically are not touched again. And unfortunately, that's a big problem.
Okay, well, I have the final article of the day, and it is on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade confetti. Some confidential information was found in that. We're just about a week removed from Thanksgiving, so I thought this was a timely article. Plus, you know, I think a nice one to finish up the day on. So during the Thanksgiving Day Parade, some of the spectators there noticed that some of the confetti had social security numbers and some police detail assignments. I think there was even one report of Mitt Romney's schedule or motorcade from earlier. And so this alarmed, Ethan Finkelstein is the one. He's an 18-year-old Tufts University student. So he noticed that, and I think he reported it to the news station. And so there's been some coverage related to this. Macy's actually made the statement that the confetti in question was not confetti that they used, that they only use commercially manufactured multicolored confetti, not shredded or homemade printed paper. So this confetti, I guess, was maybe not part of the official Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, but it was nonetheless discovered and found. The police department in question has said that this is not in line with their policy, and they will be doing an investigation, and no further details have been released regarding that. It was interesting kind of reading through the articles related to this, in that there was a similar incident in New York earlier this year during the Super Bowl parade for the New York Giants, except in that case, people were actually throwing whole reams of confidential paper like out the window. So that article, it was interesting reading it now, you know, months later. Basically advised you should shred anything before you get rid of it. So in this case, the documents were shredded, but there were still confidential pieces of information that could be seen. It looked to me, you know, there's some description of how the shreddings were. It sounds like the sheets of paper were shredded horizontally, not vertically, which made it a little easier to see details such as, you know, social security number. You know, you could see that you actually read a line of text. And in some cases, there were confidential information on those lines of text. And it certainly looked to me, from what I could tell, that there wasn't like a cross cut or a diamond cut or any kind of, you know, it looked like a singular kind of shredding machine. So, you know, this information was released, you know, was basically, you know, found in a very public area. You know, from what I've read, you know, I think it'd be difficult to kind of tie a lot of information together, but, you know, you would at least, you know, it is concerning that, you know, social security numbers were disclosed. Even if you don't have the person's name, you do have a valid number, and who knows if that could actually be used for something. And you know, so there were some details that you could kind of read a little bit. I don't think people are actually able to gather enough to put together, you know, put back together pieces of full information. And I think the real issue here is that, you know, a police department has a process in place to get rid of this confidential information. You know, they obviously do shred it. And according to the department, you know, their procedure is to then burn the shreddings. That obviously did not happen in this case. They were not sent to burn piles, but they were released. Again, we don't have any further information on that, but I thought this would be an interesting one to discuss and talk about, you know, kind of how we should treat our, you know, our documents, you know, including, you know, business documents and personal documents. Most of us have shredders at home. What should we be doing? Is clearly this illustrates that shredding may not be enough in all cases.
Yeah, clearly they didn't do a very good job. If you look at the picture, you can, you know, clearly read some stuff, and the fact that they were able to decipher some of this information easily just by looking at it was interesting. In places I worked previously, not here at Purdue, but previously, we had confidential bins, which were locked containers in which you would stick sensitive information. And then in theory, those were gathered up once a week or whatever and taken to a commercial facility or shredded in a truck right outside the building. So it's a little interesting to see that in this case, the information was shredded, but not quite correctly. But it also brings up the issue of if you are using a commercial confidential shredding company, what guarantee do you have that your information isn't being shredded or is being shredded, but not maybe sufficiently? So I wonder if this was something they did in-house. It's not really clear whether it was or not, or if they hired a commercial company to do it. Of course, that brings up the question of what we do here at Purdue. At least I know at Sirius we have our own shredder for confidential stuff, and everything else is recycled. But we have a cross-cut shredder, so it creates the very small little flex. This with the long, very long strips. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting how this showed up there. Clearly, there's not enough information to go on to speculate, unfortunately. But if you have insensitive information, you might want to revisit your shredding policies. And if you're using a commercial company, you might want to look into how they do it and what guarantees you have and if you can visually inspect the result.
Well, kind of taking a kind of bad news and turning it into good news, I guess people are pretty aware of this issue since it's in the news. I mean, I don't know who reported it, but it's kind of, I guess, good news that it was reported, and people aren't like, well, social security number. This is a bad thing. So over the years, I think the awareness that this is an issue has definitely become better.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting, again, not, kind of just going on the details we have, it appears that, the shredder that was used in this case was probably an older type machine. You probably really can't get machines like that anymore. I think most of, at least, a commercial grade machine, So this may be an artifact of a process that was created, 10, 20 years ago or longer. And, it might have been sufficient at that time, the process they had in place, but times may have changed. I don't know that for sure. Like I said, we don't know the details, but I think it's a great illustration to kind of revisit how you handle your documents, both in your business settings. There tends to be a more, I guess, official process in the business world for the most part. I know our department also has a cross-cut shredder. It's a really nice machine, really quiet too. The advances have been great, and you really can't get much at all. I mean, it's pretty shredded. It's really hard to be able to read anything on that. But I contrast that to what I have at home. I've had several different shredders over the years, and I know there was a time when the shredder I had at home was pretty weak. It wouldn't have been difficult to get some information, and I would use different techniques, mix those shreddings up and things that, if someone's going to go through my trash, you're at least going to have to dig through things they might not want to dig through to try to piece it together, So I tried to add some additional security to it, or separate the shredding so that it would be difficult to kind of put documents back together. I think it just all comes down to knowing what you're shredding. It was interesting. I was talking about this article before the podcast, and at first I'm like, well, maybe everything that was shredded wasn't confidential. But then I thought, why would you really go about shredding it if it's not confidential? But I know some places have a policy, just kind of shred everything. But for the most part, the fact that it was shredded probably says the information in there was information that needed to be protected or was of a confidential nature. So probably just a good reminder to, treat those documents appropriately and review the processes and procedures they have in place. And I would imagine that the police department involved in this is going to be changing their procedure. They're going to be correcting it. If it wasn't a problem with the procedure, they're going to be correcting whatever the issue was, making sure it won't happen again. So it could be a good thing that the police department's, impacted by this will be changing their policies.
Yeah, and this goes to a higher level issue of basically classifying the types of data that your organization has and then setting certain restrictions on its use and storage and disposal. And a lot of organizations don't have that. We talk about the government space, we talk about top secret, secret, unclassified, that sort of thing. But even organizations can have a sensitive information category and restricted category, those sorts of things. And say, you know, if it's restricted, then it's only shared with those who need to know. If it's sensitive, then it can be shared with anybody within the company, but not outside. And then, you know, when it's time to dispose of those things, there's a procedure for that, whether that's, you know, shredding it through a commercial company or shredding it in-house and disposing of the remains, that sort of thing. That should be part of an information classification policy and procedure of any organization. If your company deals with sensitive information, and if you have employees, you have HR records, that's sensitive information. Okay, so pretty much every organization is going to have some amount of sensitive information they have to handle in certain ways. And some of that is, you know, make sure everybody knows what to do, have a policy that defines it, a procedure that describes it, but also have a labeling standard that says when you write a document and it has sensitive information, you have a header, a footer, or even a cover page that says this information is sensitive, it's classified, it's whatever your terms are. And that's a bigger issue that most organizations have not addressed. And once you have that, then it's fairly easy to train all your employees and say, okay, when you create something, figure out what kind of information is going to be in there and label it appropriately, and then follow the procedure for getting rid of it when you're done with it. So this kind of a, you know, that's, this is kind of a higher level policy issue of making sure you classify the information you have and define what to do with it.
All right. Well, I just wanted to correct myself. The student or the person who reported it was Ethan Finkelstein, who's an 18-year-old college student. So with that, we'll wrap up the podcast. I wanted to thank Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius and Secure Purdue. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.